First Empire podcast of 2018. We say hello to Jason Isaacs. That's a catchphrase that's going to catch on. And his Star Trek Discovery co-star Sinequa Martin Green. Plus, Andrea Riseborough, star of Black Mirror, pops into the pod booth and listens to me bang on relentlessly about Mindhorn. All that and more on the movie podcast that has a bigger button than your podcast-ish. That's not true. I can't back that up. Please don't ask me to back that up. Hello, pod. I'm Chris Hewitt, and welcome to the First Empire podcast of 2018. Merry Christmas. Happy New Year. Happy holidays. How are you all? That's good. How are the kids? Excellent. I'm joined this week by two colleagues of such lethal cunning. We have our geek queen, Helen O'Hara. And Helen, as your Christmas present, I've decided to stop crowbarring in Supernatural references and Hamilton references.
Thanks, Chris.
I'm not throwing away my shot, Helen.
Oh, God.
When it comes to not referencing the award-winning musical Hamilton.
When do you go to see it?
I go to see it on January 25th and then again on February 6th. And I'm trying to get tickets on every single day. Forget my computer, didn't turn it off. That's unprofessional. And I'm trying to get tickets every single day on the lottery here in London.
Yes.
And I tried every day when I was in New York before Christmas for a holiday and just came up short. Bupkis, as they say over there.
Wow.
They go, hey, Bupkis, what do you got in the Hamilton lottery?
Is that
I
what
got Bupkis. Yes, what they say. I assimilated the New York accent. Hey, what's with the? That's what they say.
Those of you playing a drinking game about whether Chris went to New York before Christmas, you've already got, three shots down.
That's a very specific drinking game.
I mean, there's going to be a lot more references, I feel like.
I haven't even mentioned my wife.
There we go.
Oh, no! You saw Hamilton, didn't you?
I did see Hamilton, yes.
With the UK cast, the British cast?
Yes.
Yeah.
Very, very good cast, I thought.
Yeah?
Different, but not in a bad way.
Okay. Interesting.
Yeah. I wrote a piece about it for another publication. The contrast between the two casts.
There are other publications?
Barely.
Well, we have the bigger button. So there you go. The bigger publish button, that's for sure. We'll talk about that more in a second.
Sure.
For the meantime, I want to bring in the other colleague of such lethal cunning. I am saying that right, aren't I? Cunning. Yes, I am. It is James Dyer.
Hello.
Our West Wing expert.
Hi.
How are you?
Yes, I'm very good, thank you.
Excellent. You seen Hamilton?
I have not seen Hamilton.
Do you want to see Hamilton?
Yes, but not enough to pay for it.
I do. Lin-Manuel Miranda is a massive fan of The West Wing. And references The West Wing in Hamilton. And yeah, as Helen said, I don't want to see enough to pay for it. So
okay.
If anyone is listening and wants to give me free Hamilton tickets, I will happily go. But other than that...
If anyone listening wants to give out free Hamilton tickets, there are so many people ahead of you in that queue, it's not even funny.
It's hard to argue. Fine.
I don't know. He's still here, isn't he? He's still... Linny Manny. He's still here, but he's not performing. So, you know, he might listen to the podcast and go, yes, you guys can come along.
I don't think he would do that. Because James is, and I want to make this clear, if Lin-Manuel Miranda is listening, totally undeserving of free tickets.
However, if you want to invite me on set of your adaptation of The Name of the Wind, I would happily go to that instead.
Oh, yeah. I'll fight you for that one.
That I'm quite excited about.
All right. So let's not talk too much more about Hamilton. But you know there's a Hamilton store. My wife and I were in New York and we were just across the street from where Hamilton is, which is on 46th Street.
The Richard Rodgers Theatre.
Richard Rodgers, of course, co-writer along with Oscar Hammerstein of the musical Carousel, which contains, of course, the greatest song of all time, You'll Never Walk Alone. Neither here nor there. But it is him, isn't it?
Yes.
All right, so... And there's a Hamilton store right by the Paramount Hotel now.
Well, it's because there's just too crazy a demand for stuff. In London, actually, the line for tickets or the line for merchandise was like insane. You had to be there about 3 hours before the show. And of course, the theatre isn't open 3 hours before the show.
Wow.
So it's quite difficult to get any T-shirts or anything in London. In New York, it was more of a mob scene, so you were able to kind of push through and get some stuff.
Well, we walked in at about midnight, just as it was about to close. And there's all sorts of stuff. There's Hamilton jumpers, Hamilton hoodies, Hamilton socks,
Hamilton handkerchiefs. Do not throw away your sock?
Hamilton handkerchiefs if you do not want to throw away your snot.
Oh, no.
There's all sorts of stuff. And I was going to buy you something, but I didn't.
Thanks, Chris.
But you know what, Helen? It's the thought that counts.
I don't think that's how they mean the phrase, but okay.
I think it's how they mean the phrase. Also, I know what you're thinking. You're thinking, Chris, what film and television related stuff did you do in New York? I'm interested. Thanks, Helen. Well, as you know, Fall and I went to see John Leguizamo's one-man show.
How was that?
Latin History for Morons.
Mm.
Very good, very funny, really interesting, magnetic performer. And I also saw A Bronx Tale, the musical.
That is not a story I would necessarily have musicalized immediately.
No.
But did it work?
It did work. Mm. I liked it.
Good.
And it is music. The songs are by Alan Menken, your friend and mine.
Yes, he's great.
And yeah, very, very good. Good performances all the way through.
And and you tried to go to the Ghostbusters station.
Yeah, yeah. Tried to. So the last day, this amazing holiday, and the last day, said, okay, what should we do? I've never been to the Ghostbusters fire station, which is Hook and Ladder 8, down nearish Wall Street, down nearish the World Trade Center. I said, okay, well, let's go. So we got into a cab and we drove down at great expense, time-wise and money-wise, to get to this place. And we got there and we were looking around for it. And it was like, where is it? It's here. It says here in Google it's meant to be here. And then my wife goes, is that it over there? The building that's being completely refurbished. And I went, oh, that's it. That's it. So it's in the middle of refurbishment. And of course, this apparently has been going on for over a year and no one told me. So thanks for that.
Okay, well, I'm sorry.
But it was not you. It was an amazing moment. Anyway, what film and TV related stuff did you guys get up to over Christmas?
I had a very upsetting New Year's Eve.
That
can be said of most of my New Year's Eves, but this one in particular. Now, just to give this some context, I decided very shortly after Christmas, I thought, I should watch something. What should I watch? And I was scrolling through and I remembered seeing an impassioned editorial on a website that I will not name. But Den of Geek basically said that Beyond Skyline was one of the greatest sci-fi films of the last decade. Like, not just like, it's better than Skyline, it's quite good. Like, this is transcendental cinema.
Geek say this as the entity that is Den of Geek, or was it someone who writes for Den of Geek who said it?
It was bylined. I can't remember the name of the actual writer, but she loved it. Like, loved it. And I think I've heard other people from Den of Geek tweeting that they liked it. Either way, this had stuck in my head. I thought, oh, I should watch that. But then I thought, I can't. I've not seen Skyline. So, Boxing Day, I sat down and watched Skyline.
It was Boxing Day. Your story is
changed. No. New Year's was beyond. This is the prologue. This is the prologue to the actual story. So I sat down, I watched Skyline. After watching Skyline, which I think we can all agree is drivel, I no longer wanted to watch Beyond Skyline, but I felt I'd begun this quest and I had to kind of follow it through. So with that still ringing in my head and traumatizing me, I sat down having, you know, I suffered Skyline to get to Beyond Skyline. And I sat down and I watched it on New Year's Eve. And it is exactly what you would think it is, a straight-to-video sequel of a shit science fiction film. It's terrible. It is objectively terrible. And I'm like, and I was texting you all the way through, if you remember this, and I was texting, I'm halfway through, I'm waiting for the good bit, I'm imagining it changes halfway through, and it does to a certain extent, in that they act out, like the first film happens in parallel to the first half of Beyond Skyline. And there's a point where all of the action transplants to another country and Iko Uwais turns up and starts beating the shit out of people.
Iko Uwais, yes,
that's it. I can never pronounce his name. He turns up in a motorcycle helmet, starts punching people, stabbing people, all the good stuff. But it's still not exciting. And Frank Grillo, bless him, gives it his all.
I love Frank Grillo.
So do I. I have a lot of affection for Frank Grillo. And I really like Kingdom, his TV show as well, when it was on. But it's not good. And if anyone has seen Skyline, I won't ruin the end, but there's a bit where you see a lot of the actual sort of, shall we say, alien creature-ish things in the ship. And they're all CG. And in this one, they've changed them from CG to men in suits, specifically so that Iko can beat the shit out of them physically.
Well, yes,
which is great, but it just feels like you're watching. Did you ever see? It was like a manga adaptation called The Guyver.
No.
Remember this Guyver?
I remember.
You know
what I
mean? It's like that. It's like a martial arts guy fighting guys in rubber suits.
I don't see the downside here.
I mean, it's fine. Don't get me wrong. It's fine if you accept what it is, which is a straight-to-video science fiction film.
Right.
But it is not the best science fiction film of, indeed, probably even the day it was released.
Well, as you know, We love Denny Geek here, but we do frequently ask him out on Twitter to fight in the car park, and they have never taken us up on it. But so I'm thinking that maybe now this may be it.
This is the Anchorman moment. It's just that we're going to call him out over Beyond Skyline.
So Simon and the Denny Geek team, if you were listening to this...
This is the hill you've chosen to die on.
Oh, my God.
And the thing is, we can get Eco Wise to fight in our team.
Yes, we could. Although not after I've just said that, probably. they may have Eco at this point, so we might need to get Scott Adkins on our side.
Scott Adkins is on Team Empire. Hashtag Team Empire.
Can we not start any beefs here?
We're starting a beef.
Can we all just get along?
I'm totally killing one of them with a trident.
So that was a disappointing start.
It was a very disappointing start. So Den of Geek, you and I have a beef now. That's
oh my God.
That's a thing.
What about you, Hellsbells? What were you up to?
I watched lots of films with the family. I also went to see a couple of plays. 101 Dalmatians on stage. Sadly done with puppets and not real puppies, but you know, you can't have everything in this life, and it was very well done. This was in Birmingham. And then I went to see another show, which, do you know what? It was so bad and so surreal, I'm not going to say what it was, because everybody involved was doing their best, but it was terrible. So that was less successful as a live show.
Really?
Yeah, it was just
give
like...
Give us a clue.
Teapots.
Teapots.
Yeah. Anyway,
Beauty and the Beast.
It was really not good. And it wasn't designed for me. It was designed for kids. We realized that after buying the tickets. But yeah, so that was fun. But otherwise, I caught up on a lot of films I hadn't seen during the year because I'm beginning to get some screeners in. So I've been catching up on stuff, which is very nice. And then made my family sit down and watch all the films I really liked again.
We don't get screeners.
No.
No, we don't. No.
Well, I'm special.
Yeah. How do you get screeners?
You become a member of the Film Critic Circle, for example.
Yeah, they won't have us.
Have you tried? Have you asked? Have you been nice?
No.
Well...
No, but they just don't like my face.
I've heard about joining circles. That. It's disgusting. Yeah. I won't have any of it.
My application.
You realize it's not like the Joshua Jackson circle.
Yeah, that's what I have in my head.
That's amazing. Cool.
What did you watch, Chris?
Stuff.
Things. Bake Offs. Yeah. MasterChefs. Yeah.
Star Wars again. Paddington 2 again.
I haven't seen Star Wars again. We are going to see it again after this. Actually, if you're
we coming,
are. We're going to go see it again because we're recording our Star Wars The Last Jedi. I'm like, this is good, Helen. You remind me to segue.
Synergy.
And this is good. Because we are recording our Last Jedi spoiler special. Rian Johnson has contributed. He has answered questions in great detail. And that's going to be up on January 15th. So we're going to record it next week and then have it up for January 15th. We realize that's a long time after the movie came out, but there you go. And so look forward to that one. And we've got our Blade Runner 2049 one coming up as well, which we've got to make room for as well. So
have we recorded that already?
No, we have not recorded that.
Wow. I will watch that again.
I need to get to that because it's scheduled to go up at the end of January. Do you get any good presents? Any good film, TV related presents?
Yes, I got The Princess Diaries by Carrie Fisher.
Very good. That's very good.
Yeah.
I recommend the audiobook though over the actual book.
Yes, I might actually listen to it even after reading the book. I thought a lot of people said that to me. So.
You, Jimbo?
Did I get anything film or TV related? I don't know that I did, to be honest. I didn't do particularly well in terms of presents this year, if I'm honest with you. But I did watch All of Six, which is the History Channel's new series about SEAL Team 6, which I rather enjoyed. And I'm looking forward to season 2, which will be this year. So that was fun.
I thought that was going to be something about Six from Battlestar Galactica, but
no. Although Olivia Munn is joining season 2 of Six. Olivia Munn, who we will of course all remember as Sloane Sabbath from Aaron Sorkin's The Newsroom. So that's that's amazing. So very.
I don't really understand the segue there, but okay.
So that's all
always comes back to Aaron bloody Sorkin eventually. I saw John Wick 2 on New Year's Eve.
That you
was
did,
fun.
Yes. Yeah. See, you had good. A much better New Year's Eve than I did.
Did I?
Was it you were watching John Wick 2? I was watching Beyond Skyline. And what was Nick watching? He was watching something.
Oh, he's watching something terrible.
I can't remember.
Something terrible.
Yeah. I went to Ollie's house and ate all the food.
Did you watch anything?
No. We talked like people.
I don't understand.
I know, it was weird.
His dog.
Oh, yeah, his dog was adorable. His dog wore a bow tie because it was a special occasion.
Well, there we go. So we've been faffing around here because we're in lieu of a question this week. So we don't have a question from readers. We will have one next week, won't we, guys? Yes, we will, Chris.
Yes, we will.
If you want to send in some questions to the Empire Podcast, let's replenish our stocks for 2018. Assuming, of course, we're all still alive next week. You can do so via a number of methods. We're on Twitter as @EmpireMagazine. Use the hashtag Empire Podcast. I did a shout out for questions about 10 minutes before we came into the booth. just having that attempt to look at them. That'll be good stuff for next week. We're also on Facebook as Empire Magazine, and you can email us as well, podcast@empireonline.com. All very, very exciting stuff. All right, time now for our first guests of the year. We all love Jason Isaacs. He's been on the podcast a few times. I believe he's been on another show, which we know about entertainment, and there's some sort of thing there, some sort of catchphrase related to him, but we don't care about that. By the way, Kermode Mayo Car Park as well. When we're throwing down with Dena Geek.
This is a dangerous,
we're
dangerous
gonna throw
time.
Down. See, Kermode looks like he can handle himself. This is the thing about Kermode.
Yeah. He's a tall man.
Kermode's a big fan of Dena Geek, so I'm saying he's probably already in the car park with them. So we're going to need to enlist some other publication as well, I'm going
to
say.
We're going to have to reach across the divide.
You think?
Link hands with Total Film. It's got to happen.
I'll reach out to the West Wing Weekly. It's fine.
Okay.
Yeah. All right. Okay.
You know what? It's really tragic, but I'm actually washing my hair that day.
Oh, are you? Oh, great,
so
Helen. Run away anytime there's a physical confrontation with another magazine.
Or one
of the country's most respected broadcasters.
Over nothing.
You run in the other direction.
I mean, I'm sauntering vaguely, but sure.
Jason Isaacs is one of the most respected actors in the UK. He's been in all sorts of stuff, from Harry Potter to Event Horizon. And now he is, of course, the Captain Gabriel Lorca in Star Trek Discovery, which is returning to Netflix as of next week, Monday, January 8th. Very, very excited about that. And he came to London November, I think it was, to speak about the show and about his role in it. And he brought with him a friend, the show's lead, Sonequa Martin-Green, who plays Michael Burnham. So Sonequa Martin-Green is the lead, essentially. It's and Jason Isaacs. She's the lead of Star Trek Discovery, which if you haven't seen, the first half of the first season is on Netflix. And I really liked it. I thought it was very enjoyable, very different. Feels like Trek, but also feels like something new. So they both came in, and Sonequa Martin-Green in particular has a lot to say about the historical significance of anchoring a show like this as a black woman. So very, very interesting interview. A lot of fun, as you might expect. So enjoy. We're delighted to be joined on the Empire Podcast by the stars of Star Trek Discovery, Sonequa Martin-Green, Jason Isaacs.
Yes.
Welcome both. Jason, you've been on this podcast two weeks ago.
I'm going to shut up because 2 weeks ago I spoke for an hour and a half. And I'm much as I love the Empire viewers and listeners, I'm sure that they're sick of me. So Sonequa, it's all you, darling.
It's impossible to be sick of you. Impossible.
Exactly.
Is it possible to be sick of Jason?
Oh, my goodness, Jason.
What's she going to say?
What if...
Well, you're shutting
up,
right?
No, I love... Jason, first of all, he's a beast of an actor, number one.
Yeah.
It's true. And we all know
for
this.
The people listening, I'm holding her cat at knife point.
Well, I don't have a cat, you guys, so no.
Well, not anymore.
Yes. He's so funny, so charming. Gotta love that.
Stop
Jason.
Now, move on.
Gotta love
it's
that.
It's nauseating.
Jason.
People are throwing up into their porridge.
Do you remember the first time the first time your characters meet? Is the first time we see you, Jason, in Star Trek Discovery.
Absolutely.
You have to wait 3 hours for it.
Yeah, a lot
when
of people...
we're doing all the launch publicity, I didn't want to say because it's, you know, it's unseemly and slightly vain to go, by the way, if you're really looking forward to seeing me, you have to wait till episode 3.
Yes,
but then there was a lot of online people going, oh, well, then why are they lying to us? He's not even in it. Unless mm-hmm. he's a Klingon.
Mm-hmm.
Episode 3 we meet. And for me, episode 3 is in many ways the second pilot.
Oh, gosh, it is.
It's when you get on the Discovery and you find out who she's going to be hanging out with for the next 10 years at least.
Yes, definitely the second pilot. You know, I love the way that we decided to tell the story, and that you get a really extended prologue, which is lovely. You know, you get a prequel within the show with the first two episodes.
Yes. It's not great for the Michelle Yeoh fans, I have to say, who sign up to get a lot of Michelle Yeoh, and they get maybe slightly less than they were expecting.
Well, they get two episodes. But it's an interesting thing because you torpedoed my little theory, my pet theory, when you signed on to the show, was that you were going to be the one who was going to be Game of Thrones.
I see.
After three or four episodes. Of course, you know, spoiler alert.
Mm-hmm. It was not the case.
Stuck around like herpes.
Yeah. So you've done the reverse Sean Bean.
Many of us have reversed Sean Bean's work in the world. We're doing our best.
You said, I want to be in it from episode 3.
No, look, I just played Sean Bean in Death of Stalin, so, you know, all credit to him.
was that where the accent came from?
No, it was Brian Glover, to be fair. A lot of people said it's Sean Bean, but I'm older. My references go back further.
Brian Glover?
I was being Brian Glover in my
head. Amazing. That's enough.
Very good.
There you go.
Started off with Jeff Goldblum, moved on to Brian Glover.
What are they talking about?
No, I love it. No, I know very well what you're talking about. Yeah. I have not seen it yet, though.
Okay.
Because I tried to come out, and it was when it was in TIFF.
Oh yeah,
And
that's the
it
Toronto
was
Film Festival.
Yes, that's right.
Not having a TIFF.
And it was sold every when I logged on to get my tickets. Every single showing was sold out.
Uh-huh. Wow.
Let's hope it continues the world over forever.
So I'll have to catch it at a later time.
Right. Well, the good news is, Sonequa, actually, it is playing right here in London
tonight,
as we speak.
At a cinema near you.
Yeah, I can Google it right now.
Snap.
Yeah. We can
she looks cornered, doesn't she?
No, I don't look cornered.
I just
you
have that appointment with my manicurist.
No, oh, please. I don't need that. But yeah, that would be lovely, actually, yeah. If you really do want to Google
it. But can I just say, I talked about Defasan for an hour and a half 2 weeks ago.
Yeah.
Let's steer it back to the magnificent.
We will. We will, of course. We will. We will. And it's like, well, I'll tell you what, while we're steering it back to you, Sonequa, I will Google.
Yes,
or Death of Stalin is playing
tonight. Don't listen to Jason. You don't have to steer anything, okay? Let's talk about Death of Stalin.
No,
all right? So it's Brian Glover, you said?
Oh, wait, he was a you won't know who he is, but he was a magnificent Yorkshire actor.
Yes,
and,
you were modeling after him.
And I modeled my accent character. Okay. In fact, I just tasted an impression of Brian Glover. I played Brian Glover.
But yes, so the first time you met, can you remember that? Because I'm sure you weren't just thrown into that scene together.
Oh gosh, yes. Yeah. I loved it. I loved it. It was I really loved the way that it was the way that it was written, the way that it was staged, and the way that our beloved Jason Isaacs played it.
She's kissing the English or British podcast listeners.
No. I mean, I'm sure that they love to hear that.
But
that's my truth. Mm. Because I really appreciated it. I found it to be very refreshing because here you have this captain who, you know, as you were saying earlier today, that you made all of these decisions to, you know, sort of be outward. Facing outward and to be sort of
staring out the window.
Yes, yeah. And to also be sort of outward thinking. So I really appreciated that about it. You know, you've got this captain. I love the, you know, I think I like to think it makes me mysterious. And
yeah.
I loved the standing. And it was very, you know, sort of, I was taken aback as Michael Burnham, which I loved. There was so much for me to think about and pull from walking into this captain's room. And I very, very quickly knew that he was very different than any captain I had ever met. And then there was also the question of why I was on the ship, because I knew very quickly also that it was because he wanted me to be there. Because that was me putting all of those clues together.
It's a great meeting scene because for the audience, particularly since it's like a reboot pilot to a new pilot, they are thinking, like she's thinking, what the fuck is going on? Who is this weird dude? Why has he brought me here? What does he want with me? And that, you know, ignited a billion fan theories online.
Yes.
And some of which are still going. Some of those questions have been answered and some of them haven't. But actually we met, I knew of Sonequa first when I was offered the job. And was thinking about whether to do it or not. I asked my mate Lenny James, who
of course,
from many things.
Yep.
And I said, "So this Sneak was in Walking Dead, which you like?" And Lenny went, "She's good people." And if that is such a ringing endorsement from someone whose opinion I trust, that was a big part of me signing on.
Did you do due diligence in Mr. Isaacs here? Did you consult?
You know,
did you consult Lenny James?
No, you don't ask him about me.
Oh, that's so funny. No, I didn't. You know, for me, it was more about Jason's work, which I was familiar with.
The tall guy.
Yep.
My episode of Boone.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
That one.
Yeah.
For sure. You know, I mean, I...
One of the Sundance films that you can't even get in the remainder bins.
I knew all of those.
Cure for Wellness.
Yep. No, I actually saw that later. But no, I just knew that I really loved his work. And so I was excited that he was on board because I always felt that he had such an intensity and such a precision as well. So I was just excited for that.
I didn't know it's the other actors in it. So I knew Sonequa's work and I heard about her, but everyone else is, oh wow, a discovery. Did I say that? Oh God, shoot me. But so some of the theatre actors, a couple of them are young, almost fresh out of Juilliard.
Yeah.
And watching them kind of find their space and find their confidence and get a little bit famous now as well. I've been around a long time, so watching young people suddenly deal with being recognised in the street, I feel like the godfather of the set. I am the oldest, but I also feel like spiritually, I'm nurturing, watching all these people, and they're all going to get episodes where it's all about them and storylines, it's all about them.
Yeah.
And it's really joyous watching people kind of spread their wings and flower.
So what I love about our cast, and I mean, I love our entire company, but, you know, in our cast, like, as he's saying, is you know, you just have this sort of entire sphere of experience with this cast. You know, you have people who are just starting out, and then you've got seasoned actors who've been at this for a long time, and who have amassed a lot of success and have done some really amazing work. And so what does link us all is our passion for the story and our belief in it and our willingness to dive head first.
Sonequa did the thing very early on, which I think she inherited from the culture of The Walking Dead. She held parties, games nights, and everybody's invited. There's no kind of hierarchy off camera.
Okay.
It doesn't matter how much screen time you get, everybody's part of the family, Sonequa's family. I hosted them because I had a house, you know, a slightly bigger space because my family was staying with me. And so very early on, we did that thing that often takes a long time when you work with people. Everyone was completely relaxed to each other and liked each other and trusted each other. Although I didn't know who half of them were because I'd never seen them without their rubber or silver heads on or something.
So true.
But it made a huge difference to the working environment. It really did, almost immediately.
Yeah, thank you. And I think that, speaking of that, you know, what I did inherit from The Walking Dead was just what it feels like to be in a familial atmosphere and in a familial environment. And I realized just how much it fostered creativity. And I knew, though, that I wasn't going to be able to, that it was going to have to be very different, because with me being, you know, the lead of the show, I realized that I would have to sort of create it in my own way, you know, sort of filter it through me, Sonequa. How will I do this? And so the practice of it ended up being quite different than it was on
it's
Walking
a tight
Dead.
Rope but to it was organize a games night and still want to win every single fucking game when you're the lead actress, and yet you still need to win
that's
Mafia.
So funny, because I'm very competitive. What will I say though is that
Mafia.
Yeah, is okay. The biggest one.
All right.
There's also charades, but Mafia was the sort of MVP of the games. But what I also do have to say is that even though I came with this sort of understanding that this is the sort of environment that we should try to cultivate here and nurture, everybody agreed. And not one person can do that. Everybody has to be of the same mind. Everybody has to make that same decision. And so even Aaron and Gretchen talk about how they wanted very early on for this to be a family. And so they made decisions based on that. And everybody made that same decision. And so we were able to do it together.
Film sets or television sets are incredibly hierarchical places, generally. And I remember my wife years ago saying, why don't you come to have lunch? She goes, I hate going to the set. You don't see it. It's like the court of Louis XIV. And everyone has to laugh your jokes. And I said, no, I see it. I quite like it. You know? But they don't have to be. Harry Potter wasn't.
Yeah.
And that filtered down from David Heyman and David Barron. And for all that Sonequa was giving credit to the showrunners, they're in Los Angeles, we're in Toronto, and it could have gone anyway, in any direction. There are numbers of sets of very successful shows where there's an awkward and tense silence around, and the lead actor strolls through, and there's a wake, you know, as they walk by. And she was very keen and successfully made sure that everybody felt like we were putting on a play going to the Edinburgh Festival.
Does part of that come from the fact that it's Star Trek, and Star Trek's a show about this, you know, togetherness and companionship and just generally inclusion and generally not being nasty. And I know that maybe Star Trek casts in the past haven't quite got on as well as they would like to.
That we've had experience with, or I have at least indirectly socially,
Next Gen,
because Jonathan Frakes came and directed our show, and he's spectacularly candid and unrepeatable.
Yes, he is.
And they're his family. He absolutely adores them. They all adore each other. They all travel a lot together. They go and appear all the time together. He couldn't wait. He said, I can't wait to introduce you to my family. And I thought he meant my family. And he didn't. He meant his next-gen family.
He was taking out pictures of Patrick Stewart. Look at him now.
I don't know about the, you know, obviously one of his stories about the original series.
Yes, that's what I'm referring to.
I love those stories. I hope that they're all true.
And what does this show mean to you? Not just Discovery, but the idea of Star Trek itself. Because, Sonequa, at that press conference at Comic-Con, I remember you getting quite emotional about one question at one point about what it meant to you to play this role. And Jason, a few weeks ago on Twitter, you're amazing on Twitter right now at the moment, by the way. Techno prisoners, keep doing it.
There's a bunch of fuckwits out there. I have no tolerance for people who don't like Star Trek, God bless them, or don't like what we're doing. That's absolutely fine.
Right.
But the white supremacists, the kind of, you know, crazy race hate groups who are pretending they were Star Trek fans, they're not watching because Sonequa's in the lead.
Yeah.
You know,
it's like, have you seen the show at all?
I got a few hundred thousand people or prepared to spend a lot of time playing Bashamol on their egos with me. So, you know, come forward.
There was one specific tweet. I think you replied to someone. Someone said, "Well, why are you in Star Trek?" You know, and you said something along the lines of, "I could have worked elsewhere for more money, but I did it because of Star Trek."
Oh, that was not one of my wittier retorts. Obviously.
No, but
It's not. I mean, there was an expectation amongst some people that this is some kind of corporate grab for money and viewers. And you know, everything is a business, it's true. But what I think the Star Trek community, who are rightly very protective of this story and legacy and the themes that they've loved for so long, they were cynical and sceptical about the people who were making it. Once the show started and once they engaged with them, it became clear that in the writers' room there are more obsessive OCD Trekkers than you're ever going to find anywhere else, you know, per capita. And they'll spend weeks and weeks discussing whether something is soft canon or hard canon. I couldn't give monkeys about that. I'm just trying to tell great stories. I presume it's gone through their filter.
Sure.
And I love all the creative stuff, but I don't... those people who tell me that I'm an actor and shouldn't have a political opinion, first of all, get the fuck off my Twitter feed if you're not interested in what I have to say. And secondly, there's a third-rate reality TV star threatening the world and selling race hatred and sexual predation in the White House. So if you don't think entertainers should have opinions, then vote him out.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well said. And Suniqua, talking about what Star Trek means to you, it seems to be the show that, you know, did you watch it growing up? Is that something that you were invested in?
No. So I had a peripheral understanding of Star Trek growing up. I remember reruns of TOS being on the television. I remember Next Gen. I remember a little bit of Deep Space Nine. I remember sort of running back and forth by the TV. Oh, Star Trek's on. Okay. Kind of thing. So I still felt like, even though I didn't sit down and watch it with my parents, that it was part of my upbringing in a very lovely kind of way. So I wasn't a Trekkie, Trekker before. I am now. That's for sure.
You corrected yourself from Trekkie to Trekker. So you clearly know the landscape.
Yeah, right? So
official now? Trekker is still Trekker.
No, Trekker isn't.
I always get confused.
Yeah, Trekker's the new. Trekker's the new term.
Just try Trekkeroony.
Trekkeroony. Trekkeroona.
We'll make that work.
What about Trekster? What happened to that? But anyway, it's astounding because... It means a lot to me in so many different ways. It means a lot to me as a black woman. It means a lot to me as a woman. Mm-hmm. It means a lot to me as a human being. It means a lot to me as an artist. It means a lot to me as a mother. You know,
pastry chef? It mean anything to you as a pastry chef?
A pastry chef? Okay. I'm not very good being a pastry chef. Right. Although I do like to bake. I hate cooking, but I like to bake. So I guess it means something to me in that way too. No, I'm kidding. Jason is notorious.
Sorry, I'm putting you off your stride. Come on.
It's hilarious.
Please carry on.
He loves to interrupt. And
is this one of the games you play in games night?
Yeah, and sort of throw you off. It's one of his favorite things to do, but I it meant a lot to me because I just really do believe in the power of storytelling, and I really believe in the change that is possible from stories. It's the reason why there he is again interrupting.
It's a question to help you carry on.
Well, remember it and ask me in a second. So I just feel that I think that people. Obviously, entertainment is one of the major spheres of influence in our society, mm-hmm. and I think that that's for a reason. I think that people really are affected and moved and changed by stories, and so this legacy in particular, with it having the sort of iconography of universality and diversity and unity and community and equality, yeah. I think with us continuing with that legacy. Obviously, then it means everything to me to be a part of it.
Yes.
Because then I believe that we all become a part of the conversation, and then we can all sort of be a part of the solution. Because the problem we're inundated with it right now, especially in America.
Believe me, it's happening in Europe.
And of course, I know. And I'm just speaking of the presidency right now. And so I think that to look around you and to turn on the news and to always see the problem. I think there are many solutions. I just think that we could maybe perhaps be one of them, we could just be part of a whole that is the solution. And I always say this: I think people need a vision. They need a vision of something before they can have action in their lives. And so that's why it means a lot to me to be a part of it.
So I was going to ask you: so when this came around, and now we'd be doing publicity for it, and once you're involved in it, you realize what the legacy is. Mm-hmm. When I look back to the Star Trek that I remember when I was a kid, I just absolutely loved the stories. Mm-hmm. I had no idea. idea I was being sold subliminally a message of unity and of integration and of inclusion. Now I look back at it in not just that, a whole bunch of other stuff. I mean, one of my favourite episodes is called Miri, about when you hit puberty, you get some horrible wasting disease and you die. And I had no idea it was, you know, a kind of metaphor for life and adulthood. And now that I have two teenage girls, I realise what utter horror all that stuff is. But I didn't realise until we looked at it again, I was doing it, that it was sending out a message at the height of the Cold War that there's a Russian there. Obviously, I'm not a black woman, so I didn't realise the significance of Uhura and the first interracial kiss and every other kind of progressive message it was sending. Mm-hmm. Did you know that young, or did you discover it with me when you started to engage with this?
No, I knew it young, because I do have a very different experience than you. So, you know, as a black woman, I did know what Uhura meant when I was a child. Mm-hmm. And I think I could probably say that anybody who feels that there is a dearth of them on the TV screen, is going to be moved by seeing it in that moment, no matter their age. And so I think that, you know, again, Star Trek has always had that. And I think that since there is such a need for a more correct mirror image of our society, since there's such a need for it, I think people recognize it in the moment. You know, I certainly think now having the first openly gay officer in an iteration of Star Trek is going to mean a lot for someone right now when they see it right now.
Where it's not the center of the story. It's just part of it. It's not, we're not doing a gay storyline.
Same with the first Asian female captain, the first black female lead. You know, it's like, this is not something that's a part of the conversation in the Star Trek world, but it unfortunately, and perhaps fortunately, is still a part of the conversation in our present day. But I think that because of the dearth of these images, that they mean something to someone in the moment, and even perhaps later as well, I think the effect sort of reverberates.
Well, we're being told at the moment by all kinds of powerful people around the world to separate into smaller and smaller groups. So just the vision of a bunch of people solving problems where it's kind of irrelevant what color their skin is or what their gender is or what their sexuality is, it sends a subliminal message that isn't front and center, but is not just incredibly powerful, but more needed than ever.
Yeah, it feels Star Trek's always presented this utopian ideal, and
Except our show, of course,
in a strange
10
way.
Years before that,
precisely.
Stuff really coalesces. And so there's a lot of friction, not between groups, but prime directive has not really settled. They're at war and people show their best and worst sides.
Though. Right. I mean, but we're also 90 years after Enterprise, though. So we're sort of like in this little, you know, we're in a kind of a pocket.
There's a small pocket, pocket in which you can operate.
Did you watch Enterprise? I don't know anybody who watched Enterprise.
Yeah.
Did, okay.
Yeah, I did. Yeah.
When you got this show, or did you watch it at the time?
I watched it when I got this show.
Okay. So you had you binged on Star Trek.
I did.
Have you been watching Discovery at all? Do you watch yourselves? And if so, have you been watching yourselves with the Klingon subtitle option? Because that is something to freak
no,
out.
No, we met the guy who did the Klingon subtitles. He gave me his card yesterday. And should I ever want something translated into Klingon, I cannot imagine a single case of that ever occurring in my life. I have his phone number.
There you go.
No, I did. When they started to do the Klingon, I mean, they take it absolutely seriously. There's Klingon opera and there's Klingon Shakespeare and Klingon, and it's a very, you can study it. I think you can do it at university. And they had the world's foremost Klingon expert writing their language to them, helping them edit, and a brilliant dialect coach. But I've got to tell you, as the other actor, when you don't know what the hell's going on, it's incredibly boring to listen to, because you don't have subtitles when you're shooting a scene. And at the read-through, the first time I had to go, we give up our lunchtime to go and do a read-through of the next script. And these people are sitting there going, and it gets 10 minutes in, and I went, we seriously got to listen. And suddenly, five heads, if they could kill, they all turned and looked at me. And that's the last time I asked that.
I'm not even lying. I have so much respect for Mary Chifo and for Kenneth Mitchell, who are just knocking it out of the park.
Because they don't just act.
They don't just do the language. They're doing everything, and just the fact that you're seeing all of that life that they're bringing behind the prosthetics and with the Klingon language. It's delineating
characters so clearly. Doug Jones, who's famously played a whole bunch of rubber people, has once again created a completely unique and idiosyncratic, fully round, rich character while wearing a big rubber bucket on his head. It's unbelievable.
But as you say, the show does operate in that small pocket before that utopian ideal. And
And well, that's why it's a, you know, there's a moral conundrum every single week or running throughout the whole thing. How do you conduct yourself? Well, how are we ever going to get to a place? It's all very well in peacetime to go, we're going to explore and we're never going to, you know, we're going to be very careful how we affect communities. But if we remember after 9/11, the Patriot Act came through and others similar, the right to silence, which was hundreds or thousands of years in its genesis here, was suspended immediately. And so all of the civil rights we hold dear, suddenly when your life is threatened, you're under existential threat, can go out the window. And that was what Snowden's release was all about. And so we are, although we're set a long time in the future, we are absolutely dealing with all of the current difficult contemporary ethical questions. The Klingon War, when you watch all the houses arguing with each other, is all about assimilation and national identity, which is something as Europeans we hear discussed almost every day on every side of the political spectrum.
But does it give you leeway as well with your characters? Because Michael and Gabriel are not the...
Captain
Lorca,
thanks very much.
Captain Lorca, I'm so sorry. I just feel like I know him so well.
One person called me Gabriel. I slept with her. I threw her to Klingons. Just be very careful.
Good point. There's a certain murkiness, especially to Captain Lorca.
Murkiness.
I would say.
I'm not sure what that means.
I would say.
What did you just say, though? You said I slept with her and then threw her to the Klingons. That's what you just said. That is murky.
Telling him to watch where he walks. That's yeah.
That's the definition
of
murkiness.
Well, I'm prepared to do what it takes to win a war because I think I'm surrounded by idiots and people who signed up to travel the world and and send pictures home. And that the people back in Starfleet headquarters haven't fully processed the existential threat we're under. The Klingons, if they win this war, will be killing or conquering trillions of people. And it's my job. I'm at the sharp end of the spear. It's my job to use this science vessel and these bunch of hippies to try and win the war. And so I'm not taking any prisoners. And I frankly have suspended all normal Geneva Convention and ethical considerations to do it. I think I've found a kindred spirit in bringing Michael Burnham onto the ship. I'm not sure I had processed how that experience would have challenged her. And she's not exactly who I thought I was getting.
Yes, I think, you know, this war is I love that it's the major conflict of our season because it just brings up so many issues and questions within each of us. And I think it has very much, it is such a great landscape for each of us to discover. each other through discovering ourselves. I mean, this backdrop of war, obviously we find out who we are at the moment of greatest pressure. And that's what's happening with everyone in the story. And I love that. I love that it's sort of having a butterfly effect, you know, outward, that everybody's on that same sort of trajectory of discovery. And I think that with, you know, with this science vessel, because like he was saying, you know, the Discovery is essentially a science vessel. And so you've got these people who, I love, you know, Lorca believes that they're hippies and sort of idiots and whatnot, but it's, you know, these are geniuses, you know, everybody's a genius in their own right. It's kind of like, you know, when you have a player in the NBA, it's like, okay, so that player might be on the bench, but they're amazing at basketball, right? And they were a champion in their hometown. And they, you know, it's like these people are so smart and the best of the best. Because Discovery is that type of ship where it's a serious
It doesn't help you knowing pie to 20,000 places when someone's coming at you with a knife.
Actually, that's what I was going to lead to before you interrupted me. But I was going to say that everybody. Everybody is, you know, you get it's a promotion to get to the Discovery.
Yeah.
So you already have to have a certain skill set and knowledge base and capability and intelligence to be there. But then you take a science vessel that is then forced into this conflict and is at the moment of greatest pressure where all of a sudden, oh my goodness, now I have to be a soldier. Yeah. And you know, and like he said, you know, he's this sort of perfect person to prime, you know, these people for this because of his own experiences before. You know, in his life, you know, it's interesting that we have both of these, you know, captains that have such deep understanding of war. The same was true for Captain Georgiou. So it's
didn't
you know
much good, did it?
Oh gosh, I'm Burnham had a hand in that. But anyway, it's mommy. So anyway, it is very interesting to see to see everybody having to sort of rise to the challenge. Yeah.
All that said, there's a bit of sleight of hand, I think, rather cleverly the writers did. They set it up. It's a war story. The whole thing's a war story to an extent, but actually, the Klingon War fades very far into the background. We get all kinds of very interesting character cul-de-sacs. The kind of the Jaws music, the throb of danger is underneath it all, but we don't really spend a lot of time in the war. Yeah. We just use it to set the stakes. It's like Hitchcock's Suitcase Under the Table. Mm-hmm. It's there, and that heightens the stakes for what's essentially deep character drama most of the time.
I got to let you guys go, but
someone's waving. You're being waved. There's a big hook. It's
taking me off here. But Jason,
so Chris, what are we talking about in 2 weeks' time?
I don't know. What do you want to talk about in 2 weeks' time?
Obviously, it's the 25th anniversary of Event Horizon. 20th
anniversary. Yeah, we'll talk about that. But can I just say a couple of last things very, very quickly? Jason Sonequa just said Lorca and not Captain Lorca, and I noticed he didn't pick her up on that. That's fine. Member privileges, I get it, it's okay. Secondly, Sonequa, are you glad now that you're on this show that it has job security? Because I imagine The Walking Dead.
That's so funny. You know, I don't like to really look at it in that way. I really don't. It's like job security. I'm too busy trying to, you know, tell this story.
Okay.
It's like it's great to be on the show and in the capacity that I'm on it.
Yeah.
But that's not necessarily something that I think about. Because that's one of those sort of
You ain't dying anytime soon.
Oh, that's so funny. It's like, you know, it's like one of those sort of outside considerations that I try not to have.
Okay, you'll be fine. Yeah. And Jason,
I'm not worried, but you know,
why would you be worried?
What about my job security? Now I'm extremely worried.
I know. Look, should he be?
I don't know. Should you be? I thought what we can talk about in 2 weeks' time. In 2 weeks' time,
there we go.
Back
it's
in
Captain Lorca.
Yeah, go on, babe.
I want
Jason's
you to have learned
security.
The Klingon. For that's enough. And then just come on, do that, and then just leave.
You said the Klingon for the Latin in Event Horizon, which I misremember all the time. Which is Liberate ex infere tutte met, or something.
There you go.
Liberate tutte met ex inferis.
I knew you'd get it right.
There you go.
Geek
you.
Yeah. Brilliant. Jason
Grazie
Sneaker.
For that.
Okay. Thank Goodbye you so to all the Empire listeners. You won't hear me for a long time, I swear.
Oh, and 5:40 for the death of Stalin at the Odeon.
Oh, awesome. Thank you for looking that up. Bye, you guys.
Bye-bye. Thanks, everyone. Okay, so that was Jason Isaacs and Sonequa Martin-Green. I wonder if she ever did get to see the death of Stalin. Who knows? Helen, perhaps you can lend her a screener.
Sure.
Yeah?
Yeah.
You never lend us any.
No, I definitely don't lend out screeners.
You don't lend out screeners?
No.
You would to Sonequa Martin-Green.
I feel like they'd probably be okay with that, but I'd probably let people know first.
Do they come with your name on them? Like on the screen?
Yeah.
Burned in?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Awesome.
And they say, for your consideration.
Oh, that's nice. That's good. They wouldn't let me in. I give Attack of the Clones 5 stars and just burn my bridges.
Seems fair.
Yeah. All right, so we have some movie news?
Yeah, let's.
What's been happening? Has anything been happening over Christmas?
There's been some news.
Yeah,
there has. The future is bright in more ways than one.
and also... Yet less,
and
fewer
yet less
ways
bright
than
for
one.
The rest of us. Yes, this is David Ayer's Bright, which was a Netflix original, which cost just shy of $100 million. In many ways, the first streaming blockbuster, I think we can kind of say. And it's terrible. And they're making another one. So that's interesting news. I reviewed this for the mag. I mean, I say it's terrible. It's terrible is a strong word.
It is.
Okay, I mean, yes, it's a fair word and it's accurate in this case, but this bugged me because I really wanted to like Bright. Mm. I really like the setup. I like the idea. It thinks it's more original than it is because we've all seen Alien Nation, which is much the same thing.
Yeah.
But it's really heavy-handed, has absolutely no nuance or subtlety, and you can kind of see where it's going a mile off. And it just, I mean, it's one of these things, it's a brilliant idea that should work on every level and kind of fails on all of those actual levels.
Deeply fails, I would say, yeah.
And I get. I mean, the film feels like it's setting up for a sequel. It's setting up for, you know, even a series, you might say. But I don't want to watch one.
I'm really. I did like one line in it. There's a line where Joel Edgerton's character, Jacoby, is talking about how they're in a prophecy, and Will Smith goes, "We're not in a prophecy. We're in a stolen Honda Accord." Now that is a good line. Everything else in it, like especially the racial stuff, because it's meant to be a huge racial metaphor, and it is toe-curlingly bad
it really
as
is.
Such. is really quite upsetting. So at the very least, they need a new rider, I think, and probably quite a bit more besides.
The direction felt a little bit rough and ready. Do you know what I mean? Like, David Ayer has done some really good stuff, and obviously he's come off the back of Suicide Squad, so it's unfortunate that he's followed out with this. But I think, yeah, absolutely, as you say, the biggest offender here is definitely Max Landis, because the screenplay is all over
it's
the shop.
Terrible. But the other thing was, watching it and knowing about the $90 million budget and so on, it doesn't feel it, does it, a lot of the time?
It doesn't. No, it feels quite small. Like, it's very dark.
We keep going back. It's very, very dark, presumably on purpose.
Not but metaphorically, I mean physically dark.
We keep going back to one building that seems to be made out of, like, shipping containers.
Yes.
And that looks like it cost about 50p. So what did the rest of the money go on? Like, it's kind of bizarre.
They paid, like, was it $4 million just for the script, which they must be kicking themselves over. Yeah, it's hard to see where the money went on that. It's a curious one. I mean, it doesn't surprise me that they've greenlit another one, because this is one of those situations where, and, you know, no disrespect for Netflix, who I have an awful lot of affection for, but they can state whatever they like about how the film did, and no one can contradict them because they don't release their figures. Mm. And they released a very confusing statement saying, and it was probably a typo, saying that this was the most successful film to debut on Netflix and one of the most successful originals. I'm like, hang on, that makes no sense. Presumably they meant it the other way around, as the most successful original and one of the most successful film debuts. But either way, it seems a bit like, is it though? Really?
Yeah. I mean, I will say in its defense, I quite liked Jacoby's character. I quite liked his sort of slightly downtrodden, sort of trying to make the best of a bad situation approach. So I guess more from those characters isn't so bad. It was just the story and the setup and the plot.
New year, new month, resolutions. Let's be positive.
Yeah.
I will
say
what I would look forward to Bright 2, which presumably they're just going to call Brighter. More fancy characters. We saw one centaur and one fairy in this. Otherwise, it's just orcs and elves. It's like, yeah, okay, let's branch. And we saw a dragon flapping over the horizon.
Yeah.
But so let's have a bit more of an awareness of the world. And let's branch out from really embarrassing kind of LA cliche stuff, like the Beverly Hills sign being rewritten in Elvish and stuff like that. I mean, let's you know, be a little bit more subtle with our metaphors.
More subtle would be super good.
Some subtlety.
There's a lot of urban fantasy out there that would be a better model than a lot of what they did. I mean, the Harry Dresden books, which are crack cocaine. Literary crack cocaine. The first couple are pretty ropey, and the rest are ropey too, but you don't care anymore because you've kind of gotten into it.
It's readable ropey.
Come on.
Yeah, it's genuinely, it's like a fantasy reacher. Yeah. It's really, really likable.
You're reaching to the choir.
And something like that does all of this much, much better.
Yes, it does.
Well, speaking of films that were seen by a lot of people over the Christmas period as well, we have Jumanji, Welcome to the Jungle, which has done really, really well, the box office, by the way.
So it
has displayed some serious legs. But we're talking specifically about Star Wars The Last Jedi, which has just crossed the $1 billion threshold and will shortly become the biggest film of 2017. But I've seen, not a huge amount, but I've seen a couple of articles and some people on the internet, and this is, don't worry, this is not spoiler special stuff, talking about the fact that they think that that is a disappointment. Because what you're doing is you're coming after The Force Awakens, which made $2 billion worldwide, third biggest film of all time. And this one isn't flying with the same force.
I couldn't believe anyone thought this was going to make as much money as The Force Awakens. And I think a lot of people expected it to be a better film than The Force Awakens, you know, and many of them were not disappointed. But The Force Awakens was the return of Star Wars. So it was a cultural event in a way that this isn't. So it doesn't surprise me at all. I think it was a blip. It was an unusual event. I think it's very hard to replicate that.
But The Force Awakens made $1 billion in the States alone.
Mm.
I mean, no film has come close to that. Not even Avatar has come close to that. And that's a lot to go up against. I mean, I'm looking at boxofficemojo.com's figures. So as of the recording of this podcast, it's made pretty much 50-50, 539 million domestic, 551 million foreign. But it does seem to be slowing down. And it's going to end up probably 1.4, 1.5 billion, something like that, which is a big drop from Force Awakens. Yes, I think you're right.
there was a perfect storm around Force Awakens. Absolutely no doubt about that. But do we think this is emblematic of something else? We know that a lot of people, or at least a very focal minority, are unhappy with... We're not going to talk about plot spoilers, obviously, but with unhappy with the events portrayed within The Last Jedi. Do we think that that has somehow bled into its box office take?
I'm sure that that noise around the film has probably had some kind of effect. But the overall, the cinema score of this film, which is one of the metrics that studios look at carefully to see the kind of legs that a film has is going to have, that has been good. Most people going to see this film have liked it and have presumably recommended it to others. So I think it is mostly the sort of generational effect that's had the drop-off. And, you know, I was reading one article, I think it was in Forbes, talking about, you know, how will The Last Jedi recover from its glowing reviews and $1 billion-plus box office. Like, this is not a disappointment by any rational standard.
No. I agree, yeah. The first time I saw is Star Wars struggling, or is Star Wars... I can't remember what the article was, but someone said, is Star Wars on the way out? I was like, no! And I've seen a lot of people go, oh, these numbers would be fine for any movie that's not a Marvel movie or a Star Wars movie or a Jurassic Park movie. This is crazy. This is a mad situation.
This is a mad situation. I do think that, that there is a conversation to be had about how long this can be sustained, how long this model of gigantic event movies can be sustained. And because people keep talking to, I'm sure, all of us about, oh, I'm so tired of all these sequels and all these blockbusters. And yet they keep going to see them, but will they continue to? Because they keep bitching about it at the same time. So there is definitely a conversation to be had about what Hollywood is doing with this approach, and if a Star Wars film every single year is too many, and if, you know, whatever else. But as long as they're good films, I don't fundamentally think people will go see them, mostly. But there is a danger of fatigue. And there's a danger of fatigue, meaning that people ignore them even if they get good reviews and even if they are good films. There's a conversation to be had, but this is not the film to have it about.
If you're looking to replicate the box office success of The Force Awakens, of Titanic, of Avatar, then you're dreaming a little bit. I mean, these were all films that were cultural events, like all of them, you know, whether it be Titanic, which was a huge, amazing visual thing that people hadn't seen before, that had mass cross-spectrum appeal in a way that few films around did. And then Avatar, which was essentially the birth of modern 3D. And then Force Awakens, which is the return of Star Wars. You know, these are all milestones. And The Last Jedi, even if it had been the greatest film ever made, was not going to make that kind of money.
Yeah. It is weird, though, isn't it? The original Star Wars, my grandparents went to see that, and I think it was the first time they'd been to the cinema in about 20 years, because they had to go see that. Mm-hmm. That's exactly what you're saying. That's exactly what happened with Titanic. That's exactly what happened with Avatar.
Because it's repeat viewing, isn't it? The box office come from repeat viewing.
Whereas, you know, and my parents were very excited to see The Force Awakens when we dragged them along to it. This time they were a bit like, oh, it's another Star Wars movie. Okay.
Yeah, the novelty's worn off.
The novelty's worn off.
Well, there's another one coming along in 4 months' time. I'll be fascinated to see what happens. I mean, long term, with this many Star Wars movies, it doesn't seem to have hurt Marvel too much. But that might be, especially with the quality of the films as it is.
And the other thing about the Marvel movies is there's a bit more room for tonal variation from one chapter to the next, that's which so point. Far we've not entirely had with Star Wars. So
I don't think any of these films coming up, with the exception of Solo, should have any impact on how you perceive Star Wars. Like, the prequels were a very specific thing, because they came along and they undermined something that you loved, because they directly impacted that story and those characters. But these films take place afterwards, take them or leave them. Like, I loved The Last Jedi, but even if I hadn't loved The Last Jedi, it would have diminished my love of the original Star Wars films in no way, and changed the way I felt about them in no way. I think they run into difficulties when they deal with Solo or Rogue One, where they're tinkering in prequel territory. But I think as long as they keep stuff in a separate timeline, afterwards not impacting that stuff, they can do whatever they want. You know, it's fine. It's fine. Take the good with the bad. Chill out, people.
Agreed.
Your childhoods remain with their virtue intact. It's fine.
Fully agreed. And we'll get into that more in our Star Wars The Last Jedi supporter special, I am sure. Okay, so anything else that happened? Not really.
A couple of little things. The Overboard remake has a trailer.
Oh my God, did you watch it?
Well, no. I mean, should I not?
It isn't good.
Okay.
It's much less creepy than the original, which is just upsetting, actually, when you watch it with a... I mean, frankly, it should have been upsetting then, but especially in with a modern head on, if you watch that, it's very creepy. Mm-hmm. Man abducts woman, makes her his wife, and lies to her. In this case, it's slightly different. It's not quite, you know, it's played more for slightly goofy, I would say, more broad laughs.
Yes.
But no, I don't think this is a film I shall be pre-ordering tickets for.
Fair enough. And Quentin Tarantino's Star Trek idea has a writer in the shape of Mark L. Smith of The Revenant. So QT himself will not be on scripting duties. Mm.
Intriguing. Mm. Very intriguing. Can I just say I've just got an early birthday present. For Johnny English 3 is going to open on my birthday this year.
Wow.
September 20th. And it's opening a day before Robin Hood and the House with a Clock on Its Walls. Although they may move now because Johnny English 3 has...
It's a behemoth, isn't it?
You want to skirt that one. You want to give it a couple of weeks, I would say. So I'm very, very excited about that. The sequel, of course, to Johnny English Reborn. I'm very excited about it. It's going to be a film. There's no doubt about that. Not a lot's happened, really. Oh, yes, this bad boy's come out. That's right. Yeah, thanks, Helen.
New Empire.
New issue of Empire is on sale right now and all good and evil news agents. Very, very excited about it. It is led on the cover. It's a 2018 preview. It is led by Black Panther. So Terry White, our fearless leader, went on set to Atlanta. It was Atlanta, yeah.
I believe so, yeah.
Went to Atlanta, visited the set, talked to Chadwick Boseman and the director Ryan Coogler, and Michael B. Jordan, and pretty much everybody involved with the film. Very, very exciting stuff. Lots of new images from the movie in there, lots of new info as well about it. And that leads to 2018 preview, which also has lots of info on Deadpool 2. And Deadpool 2, the marketing for this movie, has been, shall we say, left field. And... So we said, hey, Ryan Reynolds, would you like to talk to us about Deadpool 2? And he goes, I've got a better idea. How about I draw you a comic strip that has no relation to what happens in the film? And we went, yeah, thanks very much. So in here we have a Deadpool 2, original piece of Deadpool 2 art by Deadpool himself, don't forget, who is a real person. And that's very, very funny.
Who lives in Ryan Reynolds' head.
He really does. We got all sorts of stuff as well from Ready Player One, Infinity War, Mortal Engines, all sorts of stuff.
Did you also see Ryan Reynolds' definitive take on the Hollywood Chrises?
No. Oh, three types of ice cream, something like that?
Yes. When I'm getting ice cream, I like to have three scoops. So there you go.
We've also done a bit of a refresh, the design of the magazine this month, so do check that out. But we obviously have... Got lots of great stuff. The news section has exclusives on Mute and A Wrinkle in Time and the new Netflix show Altered Carbon, and Richard Linklater talks about Last Flag Flying, and there's a piece in there by Helen O'Hara about House of Cards. Someone talks to John Krasinski. Who is that? Who talks to that?
Oh, that was me.
Oh, was it? Yeah. We also got Ghost Stories. We've got Tomb Raider. I've got Helen Mirren in there. First look at Robin Hood. First look at the Meg, Jason Statham versus a giant shark. Megalodons are extinct. Marine biologists.
But so are mermaids, Chris.
This is true. We've got tons of stuff in there as well. The feature section is equally brilliant. What else? What's in the feature section? Oh, look, it is. It's Tom Hanks and Meryl Streep in conversation, talking about Steven Spielberg's The Post, which is all sorts of good. We have the first report from Joe Cornish's new movie, The Kid Who Would Be King. We have a first look at X-Men Dark Phoenix with director Simon Kinberg, Terry Gilliam's The Man Who Killed Don Quixote, Bumblebee, all sorts of stuff. And I got to go to LA last month to talk to Guillermo del Toro and Doug Jones about their illustrious career together. Not only have they made The Shape of Water, but they've made Hellboy 1 and 2 together, and Crimson Peak and Mimic, and Pan's Labyrinth, of course. And so their extraordinary career together, and they're great friends, and that was a whole load of fun. And the Empire interview this month is Rachel Weisz, who is awesome. Very, very quickly, the review section focuses on Brawl and Cell Block 99. There's a great piece on Austin Powers and how the look of Austin Powers came about 20 years on from Austin Powers, just squeaked in before the anniversary expired. Doug Liman talks about American Made and The Wall. And we have a new thing. We have a new regular called The Ranking, where a group of Empire writers get together and we take a subject. In this case, this month, Christopher Nolan. Next month, it's going to be Stephen King adaptations. Month after that, I cannot say. And we argue the toss on them, and then we rank their films, coming up with a definitive, definitive Empire-stamped
top 10.
This was a lot of fun, that bit. It's like a mini podcast transcribed in your issue.
And it is, in fact, going to be the full thing, because you get an edited excerpt in the magazine, and the full thing will then be released as a podcast. Not the Christopher Nolan episode, because I deleted it.
Super good, Chris. Thanks. Yeah.
But it's totally fine. Everything else is fine, and it's all good. So pick that up. On sale now, All Good and Evil News Agents. Andrea Riseborough is one of the most versatile actresses. I mean, last year, for example, alone, she was seen in The Death of Stalin, Mindhorn, Battle of the Sexes, three vastly different performances. Plus, she shows up in the Black Mirror episode, Crocodile. And so she came in to London just before Christmas to talk about that. I went along to speak to her, and a good time was had by all. Enjoy.
We're delighted to be joined on the Empire podcast by the star of episode 3 of series 4 of Black Mirror, Crocodile, Andrea Riseborough. How are you?
I'm good. I thought it was episode 1, actually.
Well, according to my thing, when I watched it today, it said 4-3. So it might be 1. You never know.
It is 1. Yeah.
Should we just go for 1? Let's go for 1.
I think it's 1, yeah.
Okay. But you can watch them in any order you want, right? So let's see. So it could be 1, it could be 3, it could be 10.
Absolutely.
There we go. So, but it is a fantastic Black Mirror episode. And are you attracted to just the fact that it's Black Mirror? Charlie Brooker calls out the blue and you go, yes, thank you very much indeed.
It was John Hillcott that recruited me. I mean, obviously along with Charlie and Annabelle, but John was the person who contacted me, and he contacted me to play what was originally the female role, which was my co-star's role.
Oh, okay.
And I said that I was really interested in the psychological journey of the male role, and they were open to rewriting it. And so what was great is they didn't then turn the female role into a man, so it was a woman-on-woman dynamic, which I felt was really believable and just something that was, you know, true to life and realistic and something we don't often see, which is odd, because I think it's just as realistic as it being a man and a man, or a man and a woman, but we just often see that you know, the dynamic the other way around. I think there was a bit of concern that she might not be, and I don't know who this came from, but somewhere up the line, quote unquote, sympathetic enough. People might not be able to sympathise with her if she was a she. But I guess that's for the audience to decide. You know,
I found her very sympathetic. I know that this is a completely different project, but I know that on Mindhorn, the character that you played was originally written as a man, and they rewrote it as well, too.
Actually, lots of films that I've done,
So is that something that you find a lot? I mean, there's obviously lots of conversations about...
I think maybe I respond to them because a lot of screenwriters are male, and sometimes there are just... a little better at getting really inside of the mindset of a guy than they are perhaps a woman, because they haven't had any experience of it.
Or it's a default setting. Is that, you know, like, I'll write the script, I'll just write about a guy because I'm a guy.
No, I don't mean that. I mean, I respond to guys written by guys. You know, when they're really truthful and human, and that's the bit that I respond to, is the humanity.
Yes.
That's what I would say is a, you know, meaty character, a good character, a whole person.
Yeah.
And so that was just the character that I responded most to, and I think was most his at that point. Journey was most interesting.
What was his name in the original draft? Your Mia in the show.
I don't know.
Just before we get onto the episode itself, I mean, you shot this in Iceland, as you said, and which you have done before. You did Oblivion in Iceland, is that right?
No, my character in Oblivion never left the house.
Yes, okay. So you were on set.
She was a stay-at-home desk operator.
So you never got to see it?
No.
Oh, my God.
No, that film for me was a soundstage, and it was really amazing, actually. It was really a beautiful set. Claudio, the DP, is really a great, just, you know, one of the best DPs, had filmed this skyscape, and they'd slowed it down because they had so much, you know, so much money. The resources were just endless, it seemed. And they projected it then onto this screen that surrounded us. And so it was like, it was a strange set to work on, because at 7 o'clock at night, it would be 7 in the morning, or you'd be doing a morning breakfast scene or something. And, and the light outside of the house, which was actually projected onto a screen, would be like real light, you know, like a real morning light. So a bit like having one of those lamps next to your bed that makes you wake up or go to sleep, you know. It's quite sort of weird to go to sleep, but you know, after you've just been doing a breakfast scene. But I spent the whole time on a soundstage, pretty miserable, in Baton Rouge, very lonely, and not getting to see Olga much, who was my co-star, and who was also in Death of Stalin with me.
Yes, indeed, indeed. It's been a hell of a year for you, between, you know, this and yes, Mindhorn and Battle of the Sexes and Death of Stalin. It's a hell of a year. You seem to be someone who wants to keep very, very busy, or it seems to keep very busy. Is that an intentional thing, or is it just a project?
I really like working. You know, I really hope to be able to offer more jobs to women in the future.
Because you have a production company, don't you, which is...
Yeah, and so that's... And, you know, when I can do that, that's very satisfying. And we're looking, you know, we're making... looking into all sorts of different things, but documentaries as well, which I'm really... looking for, I'm really enjoying that process. I'm really looking forward to that too. Like work, and I feel alive in the face of it. You know, I feel energized by it. And the thing I find it harder to do is talk about it. I'm not very good at talking about it. I don't like that so much. Like this, I'm not very good at this.
Well, I'm terrible at asking about it. So
no, I'm sure
you're not. We're going to be fine.
I'm sure you're not.
What do you mean, I'm sure you're not? We're 8 minutes in. You've established by now that I'm terrible. But what about your preparation? Because when you are working so often, so prolifically, and I know, for example, and it's weird. I keep bringing Mindhorn up, but I know from having spoken to Julian and Simon about that movie at great length that. You came on quite late in the process, in that one. And you came straight from another project as well.
Yeah, and I think they were all really surprised that I said yes.
They were like, "What? We've written the script, and now this amazing actor wants to be in our script. What's going on?
I mean,
what have
that's
we done?"
Very kind, but I think they're just. I was Skyping with Sean Foley, and I was shooting something in Africa, and actually with Steve Coogan, because Steve's in both, you know.
Yeah.
And Steve, I think, was executive producing it, or he was part of producing, you know.
Yeah, he was involved.
And, I said that the first thing I said to Sean was, I'd just love to do this. And he said, would you? Not because it was I mean, it was clearly just a wonderful, wonderful piece of work.
He's checking around for hidden cameras.
Because I had like 5 days in between things, and you know, it just seemed like the last thing in the world to go off and do after doing a story about capital punishment during apartheid. But we did, and I mean, that was, you know, I was on set pretty much every day. It was great. It was one of the best experiences I've had. It was so much fun.
Shooting in the Isle of Man, which is, I imagine, is very similar to Iceland.
Yeah.
In many ways.
No. Nothing like Iceland.
Iceland doesn't have a Laxi wheel, though, does it? One nil to the Isle of Man. Well, then you could also say Raw Shark. That's a point away.
I know. Yeah, people are really captivated by that. Humans are odd, aren't we? Like, in the way that we get really obsessed with how some things are cruel and other things aren't cruel, like leather or pig factories or shark underground or mink. That everything's in a different, I don't know, sort of funny set of rules we have for different animals.
We're very selective about our luxuries, aren't we?
Yeah, some of them we give like cat beds. We keep them inside, and then the other ones are like, you're a rat, you stay outside, you've got no place in a house. We're just such odd creatures.
This is true. I think it's maybe it's a question of volume with rats. There are so many of them.
and they've been linked for so many years with diseases.
There are quite a lot of cats. So imagine if all the cats were running rampant around the streets of London, passing on disease. We'd look at them very differently. And what if we had all the rats inside the houses and we were sort of like stroking them and being like, this is Fluffy, my pet rat.
Yeah.
And that was the most normal thing in the world.
Well, it's interesting. When people do have pet rats, there is a certain tendency. Even then, people go, that's a bit weird, isn't it? To have a pet rat. But
yeah, maybe. I mean, yeah. It's weird to have any pets.
I guess it is, when you look at it that way.
It was like really weird when Goofy had Pluto. Everyone was so confused by that. I think we all still are.
That's a dog owning another dog.
Yeah.
Or is Goofy a dog? I don't know.
That's the big question.
It is the big question. Do you have an answer for it? What's your personal theory?
Dude, I'm not Walt Disney. I'm just here to talk about Black Mirror.
But the script for this one, the script for Crocodile, so it appealed to you. And what was it specifically as well, apart from the character that you wanted to flip around and play? What was it about this idea? I can't talk too much about the plot, obviously, but there are interesting notions in this about guilt and memory and being haunted by the past. Was that something that grabbed you from the off?
It just felt very human, like very, you know, very human story. And very, memory's such an unreliable source, so I felt like that was really interesting. It's not a new concept, the idea of memory being a source, you know, legally or like bearing witness, or which is so odd because it's such an unreliable thing, and so dictated by perspective and senses and... it's not a hard and fast truth, if you will.
Yeah, of course.
Whatever that means, you know. But, yeah. So I found that really interesting. And the idea of the sort of ridiculous notion of, which seems, you know, so possible, insurance companies using it as a sort of reliable source. Because I know for me, my memories are deeply unreliable. I can't imagine why anybody would think that they were an accurate source of, you know, an accurate historical source.
Yeah.
We were talking about it earlier today, but your perspective of this room will always be forever different from my perspective of the room. And so in that sense, already you've got two perspectives. It's just two people.
Yeah, of course.
And then you get 1,000 people in the room and what really happened?
Yeah.
To some people, it was just a picture of wallpaper. And to some people, there was a murder. And to some people, there was a baby was born. I mean, you know, what is the truth? You know,
what's going on in this room?
Well, it's just such a weird and unreliable thing to base.
It is.
Especially like the, you know, the paying out of money. Yeah. I really like that idea that the insurance companies had taken it to such an extent that you needed proof.
But assuming we are around there next year, what's next for you?
Got 4 films at Sundance, which is great.
So you'll be back there, more snow.
I know. Well, I get back home first, and it's like 90 degrees at home, and there's fires. So the complete opposite, and then just get thawed out in time to go back to get some altitude sickness. And one of the films is in competition. It's a film that my company were part of making.
Fantastic.
So really, really excited about that.
Brilliant. That's great. So four films, and presumably you'll be talking about each of them.
I'll be there doing the rounds.
So this comes back to the idea of memory in a way, because I know sometimes you'll be talking about a film you maybe made 2 or 3 years beforehand, before the interview even happens.
Right, and you thought you were good in it, but actually you were crap.
You were never crap. You were always good. But the memories of making a film. Well, it is the truth.
You might have a shaky memory.
we'll have to implant a note into my brain and see whether I actually do remember that way.
Yeah.
But I remember you being good in everything I've seen.
That was a bad performance. I don't know how I forgot that.
Yeah, she was looking at the camera. Like,
maybe you just had like really nice bag of M&Ms or Revels or something. It just made you feel better about it.
It's all about my experience.
Yeah.
But do you ever find that the old memory fails you when you're talking about projects you maybe made two years ago?
I've been sitting in a room before. There was one year that I had three films at Toronto or something. It was a while ago, and there were moments when I was sitting in a room and people were asking me questions, and I honestly was like, which one are we talking about again? Just because of sitting in that same, sort of as a human being and sitting in that same position, you know, like that where you and I are sitting in now, and the people have come in and gone out, and I've been looking at these two lamps and your head, but before that somebody else's head and this mirror behind it for so long that it can become a bit like Groundhog Day. Yeah. And even when the questions are completely different and, you know, all over the map, and it can get very... I just think my memory would not be a reliable source to anyone. I am very good at like remembering, you know, verse and poems and stuff like that, because that's my job. But basically all the information up there is useless, I would say, unless you want a monologue.
Well, no, but it'd be good for a podcast. But so if I asked you to remember what I was carrying when I walked into the room 20 minutes ago, would that be a struggle?
You're carrying this.
I was carrying that, the pole, the big tripod thing. It's not a test.
You're basically carrying everything that's like set up now.
See, it's there in front of you. It's all good.
That wasn't a difficult question.
All right, so shall I ask you about your first day in Crocodile very quickly then? Because I imagine...
Okay, first day in Crocodile. First day in Crocodile was my assistant Susie got an awful tummy bug and puked all over the, God bless her, trailer. She was so ill. And so it was... So I was just helping her. I was just cleaning up in the house and stuff and helping her because she was really, really ill. So that was the beginning of Crocodile for me.
And there you go. Started as you mean to go on.
Yeah. And it was all uphill from there.
Fantastic. Andrew Reisman, it's been a pleasure. Thank you
so much. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, so that was Andrea Riseborough. Did anyone watch the new series of Black Mirror when it came onto Netflix?
Not yet. No spoilers.
I've only seen the one episode. The one with Andrea Riseborough in it.
Sure.
I watched the very first episode of Black Mirror because I'm coming to this a bit late.
Okay. All right. Well, we'll have a viewing party. It'll be fun. Helen fun. Buried under a... yeah. Buried under screeners. All right. So time now to talk about this week's big releases. And there's only really one place to start, and that is with All the Money in the World, which is the new Ridley Scott film, second in almost a year. About the kidnapping of Paul Getty, the grandson of J. Paul Getty, who was the richest man in the world back in the 1970s. This movie, you may have heard some brouhaha. Of course, J. Paul Getty was originally played by Kevin Spacey. And when all the allegations and accusations about Kevin Spacey broke a couple of months ago, Ridley Scott swung into action, quickly replaced Kevin Spacey in the role, and replaced him with Christopher Plummer, who was apparently his original choice for the role. And so, is it hard to watch this movie, which is about the attempts to get Paul Getty back from his kidnappers and led by his mother, played by Michelle Williams, and one of Getty's fixers, played by Mark Wahlberg, on full Wahlberg form? Is it hard to look at this movie without thinking about Spacey and Plummer and all the shenanigans that have gone on behind the scenes?
I think it's hard to start watching this movie without thinking about that stuff. I think because when you're first introduced to J.P. Getty and Plummer comes in, he's quite obviously composited into the scene. You can see where he's been replaced. And I think that and the knowledge of the history of why it's happened is quite glaring. Honestly, though, it lasted about 15 minutes for me. And after that, Plummer absolutely inhabits that role. He's incredible in it. I haven't seen Spacey's performance, obviously, but I can't imagine him doing it better than Plummer did.
Well, we saw a little bit of Spacey's performance in the first teaser trailer. Mm. And I do wonder, because I think all the way through the movie you'd be going, those prosthetics aren't good.
Yeah, it would have been distracting.
The makeup's not good.
It would have been distracting.
Yeah.
Plummer is really, really good. I mean, honestly, for me, the standout for this is just, I mean, Ridley Scott doing this in that short period of time is extraordinary, because it's not like it's a couple of scenes. He has a significant presence in the film. Mm. And to have redone all of that with that turnaround and actually make it look so seamless and so good, with the exception of literally about three shots where it looks like there's been some digital trickery, hats off to him.
Mm. He works fast at the worst of times.
Oh, he's a machine. You know, he's an absolute
incredibly
machine.
Fast shooting. But in this case... apparently, because he already knew exactly what the edit of the film was, he shot absolutely no more than was necessary.
Yeah.
Absolutely, just boom, 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 got it all in the can. Incredible stuff.
I just got a notification, actually. He's just made another three movies in the time it took you to finish that sentence.
Well, I feel bad.
Kind of amazing. But the movie itself, Jimbo, what did we think of it?
I enjoyed it a great deal, actually. I thought it was very compelling. Michelle Williams is incredibly good as young
phenomenal
John Paul's mother. Although this was ruined for me slightly after the fact.
Don't finish what you're going to say.
You know what I'm going to do.
I know what you're going to do. You talked about it on Twitter. Save that
if
for a couple
you
of
watch
weeks' time. Oh,
the
God.
Episode of Friends where Phoebe first meets Mike's parents and puts on her super posh accent. If you watch that first, you cannot get it out of your head when thinking of Michelle Williams because she sounds just like her. So don't do that or think about that or let anyone tell
I
you.
I think
that.
There's a real Catherine Hepburn vibe going on. It's a very ye olde.
Hello, Bitsy.
Yes, very ye olde Hollywood accent from Hollywood, and which apparently is not a real accent. I read this somewhere over the Christmas holidays that the voice that Catherine Hepburn and Betty Davis and people like that used in the 1930s and 40s was coached into them by dialect coaches so that they would be understood across the country. And so they don't, there isn't actually an American voice like that.
No, there isn't. Although so, I think Hepburn's own sort of Bryn Mawr accent is probably the closest of the lot to it.
Mm. Well, but you learn something new. I didn't know that either.
God,
I'm learning and growing as an individual.
I thought they got it all from Friends.
But yeah, I thought this was a very, very good film, very solid film. It perhaps goes on a little bit too long.
It does. It loses momentum, I think, in the last
takes a few too many liberties.
Yeah.
We've discussed this, and we will very, very quickly discuss this, but Williams is amazing.
Yep.
Plumber, emergency plumber, the call-out fee was well worth it, because
yes.
He's very, very good indeed. And Wahlberg is basically playing Mark Wahlberg in this film, but in a three-piece suit and with a really fancy pair of glasses. And we were discussing this, whether he's actually good in the film. I think he is good in the film, but I think he's hamstrung slightly in the way like Keanu Reeves is hamstrung by focal patterns and by the fact he has a very narrow focal range. And I'm not saying that you get Mark Wahlberg in to he could never play Bond, you know what I mean? He always has a touch of the Wahlbergisms about him. But this is a very good actor. He's been Oscar nominated in the past.
Well, but I think
he's good in this.
He works very well as a lead. And it's the same way that Keanu does. Like, you know what you're getting. It's a Wahlberg lead. It's a Keanu lead. But as a supporting kind of character actor, he isn't a character actor. He's just Mark Wahlberg playing Mark Wahlberg. And when he's not the title character, it's a little distracting. Because you're like, oh, yeah. Cause, oh, there's Mark Wahlberg.
Yeah,
yeah, but nevertheless, but good, can't fault him. And those glasses were striking.
They are very striking. You'd like it, Helen.
Ooh, glasses.
Yeah, good glasses. All right, so we gave All the Money in the World, All the Stars in the World, bar one. We gave a four, four English stars. That is, of course, a recommendation.
It is.
And also out this week and worthy of your time is Scott Cooper's Hostiles, which reunites him with his Out of the Furnace star, Christian Bale, plus Rosamund Pike, plus Wes Studi, and is a brutal Western road trip, essentially. Is this fair to say?
Yeah, I think that's entirely fair. Now, it's cards on the table, bloody hated Out of the Furnace. I thought it was so incredibly boring.
And you loved Black Mass, right?
No, I really didn't like Black Mass either. But this, I thought, was a real return to form for Scott Cooper. I thought it was much, much better than either of those. So we're starting in New Mexico in 1892. So this is kind of the time of the Indian Wars in the US. And Joe Blocker, Christian Bale's character, is an army captain who's ordered, really, really forced to escort a dying Native American chief who's played by Wes Studi and his family back home to Montana. He is dying and he wants to die and be buried back in his homeland. And the army, I think, a little bit worried about sort of the public relations side of things, have agreed to do that. Now, Joe has spent much of his life fighting Native Americans of one tribe or another, is presented as a racist, prejudiced, angry, very violent guy. And what the film becomes is a slight journey towards something resembling redemption or some kind of emergence from the trauma that's led him to be in that state. Or I don't know how you want to put it, but it's a genuinely quite convincing and sometimes quite moving look at a guy kind of recovering from his own worst instincts. Mm. Against that is the opening of the film, which concerns Rosamund Pike's character. And I don't want to say too much about it because I think it should be as shocking to you as it was to me. But it is, even though Dan gives it away in his review.
Don't read the review.
Read the review until you've seen the film.
Just read the star rating.
But it is one of the most shocking and upsetting beginnings to a film that I've seen in quite some time. And it, basically her character is traumatized by it and is sort of found and rescued, if you will, by Joe and kind of has to try and recover from that in the course of the film as well. And it shouldn't be possible for either of those two people to in any way recover from what they've gone through, quite frankly. But I think the film manages to make it seem plausible and give you this sense of hope throughout some really, really dark and violent times. And it's really, really impressive. Wes Studi and Adam Beach and Kira Orianka Kilcher and the rest are really good, but they're very much resigned to supporting roles here, which is perhaps a slight fault. I think maybe it would have been better to have a bit more interaction there.
Is this film going to upset me? It sounds traumatic. I really, really want to see this because I watched Godless on Netflix just before Christmas, which I loved. So I'm in a very Western place now. I really want to watch this.
There's nothing of this sort of... Basically, you get very upset about rape scenes.
Yes.
And there is not a... That's not the,
okay,
the kind of violence I'm talking about. Well, that's not the kind of graphic violence I'm talking about.
Having read Dan's review, though, I think you might get upset about it.
Yeah, you, I mean, okay. Yeah,
okay,
there is,
great. So it's going to be traumatic, but I might enjoy it regardless.
I think it's really, really good. I'm not, as I say, I'm not a big Scott Cooper fan in recent years. I'm not a huge Western fan generally, but this, I think, is one of the good Westerns. And also, by the way, the rest of the supporting cast as well. You've got Timothée Chalamet in his, 16th great performance this year or great film this year. You've got Jesse Plemons once again turning up in a good supporting role like he always does. You know, it's a really, really good cast. So, 4 stars from us.
Sounds good to me.
I should watch it.
Yeah, maybe check it out this weekend. 4 stars then for Scott Cooper's Hostiles. And we wanted to mention as well, we didn't really get into The Greatest Showman, did we, in depth because of the pesky embargo.
We didn't get into it at all, Chris. We didn't break the embargo, Chris.
We did not do that, Helen. And I'd like to see you prove otherwise. Very, very quickly then, The Greatest Showman, which now people have seen it.
They've probably seen it already, yeah. But it's quite a sort of charming, extraordinarily old-fashioned musical. Hugh Jackman plays P.T. Barnum, the near penniless drifter who became a circus entrepreneur because that's a thing, or at least it was at the turn of the 19th to the 20th century. He makes a fortune to keep his wife Charity, played by Michelle Williams in her second appearance recently, and his kids, but then gambles it all on a tour for an opera singer, Jenny Lind, played by Rebecca Ferguson, who is slightly unfairly made into a bit of a villain in this film. And actually, real life suggests that she was pretty awesome. But it's a little bit, it's very, very broad. There are scenes that are not very good. And it's really kind of
sold
broad strokes. But honestly, it's got incredibly catchy tunes. Like, I've been listening to the soundtrack on repeat. And it kind of just wins you over through sheer determination to do so. It's just kind of relentlessly charming, and you find yourself humming along and going with it somehow, or at least I did. Someone did describe it as all chorus, no verse, and there's probably a fairness to that. It doesn't really have the depth that you want it to have.
It's no Hamilton, is what you're saying.
It's no Hamilton, but then what is?
I've been thinking a lot about this film and how it's gone down, because there are certain people I follow on Twitter to whom this has become essentially the most important film of all time. And I remember having a Twitter exchange with Robbie Collin where we were a little bit baffled by it, because while it's fun and decent and there's an interesting decision to have an old-fashioned musical, which is what it is, kind of whitewash Barnum a lot, I would say. But you also have this old-fashioned musical that has really modern pop songs. I'd be curious to know how this is going to date. But anyway, so we're discussing this, like, what is this? You know, what is it about this? I mean, this seems to be a film that's almost beyond film. You know, is people's liking of this movie beyond irony? Is it almost like you and I with Fast Five, for example? Mm-hmm. It feels to me like this is the Fast Five of musicals.
That's not unfair,
in a
probably,
way.
Is it? Yeah.
It feels like that.
It's very colourful. It's very sort of big-hearted, heart on its sleeve, kind of broad strokes, you know, dares you to dislike it kind of approach, I think, in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
and you know, very much, especially in Hugh Jackman's performance like that, is very much, I think, where he's coming from.
It's a very, very committed performance, and he really, really goes for it, as does everyone, Zendaya and Zac Efron and Michelle Williams. And who knew that Michelle Williams could sing, and who knew Rebecca Ferguson could sing? Not the one that we knew could sing, but the one that we didn't know could sing.
I think she's not actually singing.
No!
Yeah, sorry.
You're kidding me.
Sorry.
No!
She's not credited on the soundtrack anyway.
This is an app. Oh, you've ruined Christmas. Next Christmas.
Anyway, 3 stars.
3 stars.
For The Great Showman.
All right. Anything else?
I think that's about it.
That's it. Okay, so what I will say is that if you want to hear more from Hugh Jackman talking specifically about the songs of The Greatest Showman and how they come up with them, because making an original musical for film, certainly, is quite a tricky enterprise. We do have a Hugh Jackman interview special that is available for you to listen to right now. Our Review of the Year special as well is out there for you to listen to. Our Last Jedi special is coming soon, as is our Blade Runner 2049 supporter special. And now if you want to see us live...
So special.
So special. If you want to see us do this thing live, this crazy thing, this crazy podcast thing, you will get your wish on Valentine's Day.
The most romantic day
of all. We are going to be recording our 300th podcast.
That's not including specials,
absolutely. So, I don't know, 400, whatever it is. So, but 300th regular episode of the podcast. We're going to be recording it live at the King's Place, which is where we did our London Podcast Festival podcast last year. Had a great time there. They've asked us back. We accepted. Very, very nice. Tickets are now on sale for that, and you can get them at www.kingsplace.co.uk. So that's on the evening of Valentine's Day. So bring your husband, bring your wife, bring your boyfriend, bring your girlfriend. Bring all of them. Bring them all. Come and see. And we're going to have some special guests, I'm reliably informed.
Excellent. We're as planned as ever.
Yep.
But yeah, we'd love to see you there. It's going to be a lot of fun. So book your tickets now. Is that it?
Yeah. That's
Are we it. Done?
We're
done.
So.
We're done. All right. Fantastic. That is it for the first Empire podcast of 2018. We hope you've enjoyed it. Join us next week for more film-related fun. We'll be joined by Joe Wright.
Ooh.
Joe Wright, director of Darkest Hour and...
Atonement. Sorry.
And Atonement, yes. No, thank
Pride
you.
And Prejudice.
This is good. Yes, no, keep it going while I'm looking up the next guest. This is, and Pan. Pan, and don't forget. Pan.
Can we forget Pan?
Joe Wright, director of Darkest Hour, Atonement, and some other stuff as well. Oh, and of course, yes, Martin McDonagh. Martin McDonagh, the writer and director of Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri. Very exciting.
Did you know the French name of that film is The Billboards of Wrath?
Isn't that a better title?
That's a much better title.
That's a better title. So
Raging Billboards would have been another good one.
Yes.
This is all good stuff. And also, just finished the podcast on a real high. The Good Place is back.
Right.
The Good Place is back.
I'll be on Netflix tomorrow.
Okay, that's it. Yep. And the new X-Files is starting as well.
And we're not that far away from new Star Trek. It is all coming up.
Happy days.
Everything is coming up, Milhouse. This is very, very exciting times. So join us next week for that. And we'll be talking about The Good Place incessantly again. That's fun. Until then, it is goodbye from Helen.
Toodaloo.
It is goodbye from James.
Bye.
And it's goodbye from me. I'm off to go to The Good Place. Thanks for listening.
Yeah.
See you next week. Bye.